reading will come to 1 Kings 18, 19 through 24. Now therefore, send and gather all Israel to me on Mount Carmel, the 450 prophets of Baal and the 400 prophets of Ezra who eat as at Jezebel's table. So Elias and all the children of Israel and gathered the prophets together on Mount Carmel. Elijah came to all the people and said, "How long will you falter between two opinions? If the Lord is God, follow him, but if Baal, follow him." But the people answered him not a word. Then Elijah said to the people, "I alone am left a prophet for the Lord, but Baal prophets are 450 men. Therefore let them give us two bulls, and let them choose one bull for themselves, cut in pieces, and lay it on the wood, but put no fire under it. And I will prepare the other bull and lay it on the wood, but put no fire under it. Then you call on the name of your gods, and I will call on the name of the Lord, and the God who answered by fire, he is God." So all the people answered and said, "It is well spoken."
In Philippians chapter number 4, or Philippians 4, Paul talks about a peace of God that surpasses all understanding, a peace that's so incredible and amazing, and it offers a great calm and sense of security for a Christian. He talks about how to pursue and achieve that peace, how to grab hold of it. And he says in one of the many instructions he gives in that chapter, he says, whatever so things are pure and holy and beautiful and just and all these positive descriptors, he says, think on these things. Meditate on these things. And then he goes on after that and he says, all these things that you've learned and you've heard and you've thought of and you've seen, do them. In other words, he says, think on these things and then do them. It is the case that the way we think, the way we perceive things, directly affects how we behave and what we do and how we act. And I don't know that there's any better example to show this, or very few examples are as good to show this than the content of 1 Kings 18 and 19 with Elijah. As we just read a portion of that text, Elijah challenges all these prophets of Baal on Mount Carmel, and he says, we're going to have a test here. We're going to set out these animal sacrifices, and you're not going to light them on fire. We're going to set out these burnt offerings, and then you're going to call on your gods. You're going to call on Baal. I'll call on my God. Whichever one answers, we know that's the real God. That's the real Lord. That's the true one. And they all say, okay, and they set up this test. They set up this experiment, and they are desperately calling on their pagan gods. They're desperately calling on Baal to come down and consume this fire to prove that he is real. No response. Then Elijah calls down on God to consume the sacrifices, and not only does it consume Elijah's, it consumes all the other sacrifices, all the other animals that were set out. And it is a monumental moment of victory for Elijah. It's an incredible display of God's realness, God's power, the fact that God is there, that the Lord is the Lord of heaven, that God is the God of heaven, the God of Elijah was the true God. You have this really high point, this really high victory then in chapter 18 for Elijah, only to really tank down in chapter 19. In chapter 19, Elijah is in a very different place. He is afraid, he is scared, he is anxious, and he's nervous. And all of this in part stems from the thoughts that are going through his mind. Elijah has some very negative, he has some very destructive, he has some false thoughts that he is behaving on that are distressing him. And I think a lot of these are thoughts that maybe even can plague some of us sometimes as well. And I want us to look at a few of these and consider a few of these things. And to give you a sense of where I'm going with this, I'll give you the first example. Here's the first thought. I won't suffer any hardship when I stand with God. I won't suffer any hardship when I stand with God. Notice the first three verses. 1 Kings 19, verses 1 through 3. Ahab told Jezebel and all that Elijah had done and how he had killed all the prophets with the sword. Then Jezebel sent a messenger to Elijah saying, "So may the gods do to me and more also, if I do not make your life as the life of one of them by this time tomorrow." Then he was afraid, and he rose and he ran for his life, and he came to Beersheba, which belongs to Judah, and he left his servant there. Elijah is so caught off guard in this scenario. Jezebel, she offers this ultimatum. She swears on her life with all these prophets of Baal that were killed, and she says, "By this time tomorrow, I will be like one of them. I'll be just as dead as they are, or you will, Elijah." One of those two things is going to happen. I swear on my life is what she's making. She's making an incredible dare there. And you wonder then, was Elijah expecting that? I'm not sure he was. I mean, he is so afraid, and then he runs for his life. Again, after he's just had this incredible moment where God has stood with him, God showed his presence, God showed Elijah, "I'm with you. None of these other gods are with these other pagans, but I'm with you." And now Elijah, taking this threat so seriously, running for his life. I don't think Elijah had ever... I think Elijah had suffered persecutions and challenges before. I don't think this would be the first time maybe he had his life threatened. But perhaps in this instance, he thought it would be different. Maybe he thought with this incredible moment in chapter 18, now the nation will repent. Now Ahab, now Jezebel will turn to God. Now the people will be restored to the Lord and their faith will be renewed. And instead, he is running for his life. He's been threatened with death. And Elijah is just so overwhelmed. At least in this moment, it seems he might have thought, "I won't suffer any hardship right now when I stand with God." It's a very dangerous thought because it sets us up for failure. It sets us up because it's a false expectation that we have. In Matthew 13, when Jesus is talking about the parable of the soils and the sowers, he talks about the seed that falls to the wayside. He talks about the good soil, the thorny ground, but he also mentions one that he calls the stony ground. He said that is a person who hears the word and then they receive it with joy. It's a person who, when you teach them, they're happy about God and the gospel, and they obey the gospel, they become Christians. But time goes on and they've been misled by this thought that I won't suffer hardship when I stand with God. They believe that going into becoming a disciple, and after that, they think everything's going to be roses and rainbows, and then they start to have problems with their family because they're making all of these positive, faithful changes in their life. Maybe they came out of the family that were devoted to some other religion or Christian sect, and now you've come out of that. You've come out of that denominationalism, and then family says, "We don't want you around for Christmas, Thanksgiving, the holidays anymore." Maybe you try to stand up and have more moral and upright character, and you're at your workplace and your superior asks you to do something that is not necessarily ethical. Maybe writing down something on paperwork or doing something to promote business practices that is not ethical, that is maybe probably legally wrong, but they want to try to get away with it to boost profits. And you say, "No, I can't do that. I'm not going to pursue that. I'm going to be truthful and honest and just and..." So we're going to let you go. We set ourselves up for failure when we have this thought, this idea, "I won't suffer any hardship when I stand with God," because that's not true. Even Paul said in 2 Timothy, all that live godly in Christ Jesus are going to suffer persecution. Doesn't mean that we're all going to suffer physical persecution. It doesn't mean that we all suffer the same amounts of persecution or the same types of persecution even. But to a certain degree, all of us will experience some hardship, some difficulty, and we need to accept that rather than be distracted by this thought, "I won't suffer any hardship when I stand with God." Another thing we see here with Elijah, really from these same verses, particularly verse 3, is this thought: I must be alone. You see in verse 3 where he goes and when he starts this flight to go away and try to save his life and try to run from Jezebel and Ahab, he goes and it says he drops off this servant. He apparently has this servant traveling along with him, and he says, I'm going to drop you off here at Beersheba. I'm going to leave you here, and I'm going into the wilderness. I'm going by myself. I'm going to leave you here because I must be alone. I don't know if he did that for noble reasons. Maybe he was trying to spare this servant's life and saying, if I get caught, I don't want you to get caught with me. Or maybe it was more selfish and he just didn't want the extra baggage. And he said, I want to leave you here and I'm going to try to fend for myself. I don't want anybody slowing me down. I don't know for sure. But it seems he's operating under this thought that I need to be by myself. I need to leave my servant here, leave everyone else back, and I need to go into this wilderness, into this place that is isolated. It's often the times that when we are most distressed and we're most traumatized by something that we have this thought to say, I must be alone. I need to go and be by myself. I talk with Megan a lot how about we have different coping styles, and when something is bothering her, she needs to vent and open up and talk about it and verbally express it. And it's funny because I'm the complete opposite. When something is bothering me and something's overwhelming me, my first thought is I need to go out and just be somewhere and think about this. I need to ponder over this for a little while. I like to go out and just go for a walk and just think to myself and let my thoughts air out to myself and pray about it. And then afterwards, once I've done that a little bit, then I'll go back and talk with Megan or talk with someone else and sort of go through that process of working, having someone else help me. But isolation and being by yourself is not always bad. It can be a good thing if it is controlled, if it is tempered, if you're not alone for too long. Because when you have this thought to say, if you had the thought that said, I must be alone just for a little while, that's one thing. But if you just say, I must be alone, I must be by myself indefinitely, that's dangerous. Because we deprive ourselves of that much-needed human contact and that communication. Sometimes we say, I must be alone, and I'll go and be with and retreat to technology instead of other people. I'll go to Netflix. I'll go to the internet. I'll go to television. I'll go to the video games. Sometimes we say, I need to retreat and be by myself because I can't trust other people. I've been burned in the past. People have rejected me. People have betrayed me. I can't be with anyone now at all. Maybe it's because of relocation. We've moved to a new place. We don't know any of the people. We don't know any of the coworkers. Maybe even in a new congregation, we don't know any of the people here in this church. And we say, I just need to be by myself because I don't know anybody. That can be dangerous. God made man and said it's not good for the man to be alone. He needs that human contact. He needs that social interaction. I don't know if I'm the only one that's ever struggled with this, but have you ever been so overwhelmed or stressed out about a situation or a struggle, and it happens maybe over the weekend, and you wake up Sunday morning and you think, I don't even want to go and be around people today. I don't even know if I want to be in church. And it's not that you want to forsake the assembling. It's not that you want to neglect Christians or neglect the worship of God. But you're just in that mode. You're in that mood where you're just like, I just don't want to be around people. I just need to be alone indefinitely. But then you end up making yourself go anyways. And you realize, I feel so much better after going and talking to people. I feel so much better being distracted by that problem and that depression and that struggle. I feel so much better being able to interact with other people. It was positive. It was building me up. It affected my mood in such a beneficial way. We need to be careful that we don't let this thought go too far. Don't try to wear those burdens by yourself. Don't try to wear them alone. God never intended for you to do that. In James, he says, confess your faults to one another, and by faults, he doesn't just mean sin. He means come and bear the burdens one another with your tribulations, your trials, the things that are weighing you down, the things that are giving you anxiety, the things that are making you struggle, whether they're of a moral nature or not. He wants us to wear those burdens together and not alone. Elijah's out here, traveling now in this wilderness, running for his life. He says, He thought, I shouldn't suffer any hardships when I stand with God. He's thinking now, I must be alone. I must go be by myself indefinitely. And then he has another thought in verses 4 through 8. And that thought is, I am worthless. My life is not worth living. Notice verses 4 through 8. 1 Kings 19, verses 4 through 8. But he himself went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a broom tree. And he asked that he might die, saying, it is enough. Now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am no better than my fathers. And he lay down and he slept under a broom tree. And behold, an angel touched him and said to him, arise and eat. And he looked, and behold, there was at his head a cake baked on hot stones and a jar of water. And he ate and drank and lay down again. And the angel of the Lord came again a second time and touched him and said, arise and eat, for the journey is too great for you. And he arose and ate and drank and went in the strength of that food 40 days and 40 nights unto the Mount of Horeb, the Mount of God. Notice these signs you see here that are just like classical depression. This is Elijah is refusing to eat. He's going and taking this journey, traveling farther and farther into this wilderness, into this desert place. He's not eating, he's not drinking, he's not taking care of his physical needs, he's sleeping a lot more. Again, he gets food and he just goes right back to sleep, and that constant need to just lay around and lounge and sleep and not eat, and those are signs of depression. And Elijah, on top of that, Elijah making that statement, if he was standing before a doctor or a counselor at that time, they would start checking to make sure there was no suicidal tendencies with Elijah here. With him making statements like this, they would start asking, are you taking any medication that is affecting your mind or your cognitive state? Do you have any access to weapons or may a modern sense we say firearms? Do you have a history? Have you ever tried to hurt yourself before? You ever made a plan to do that? Do you have any direct intention to try to do that right now, to try to carry that out? They would be very much checking for these things because Elijah's showing all the signs that that could be a possibility. He is just unable, though, to be optimistic. He sees himself as worthless because his effort to try to transform the nation, maybe he thought the peak of that, the best he could do was in chapter 18, and for him it didn't work, and now he says, what's the point? What's the point of living? Why does it matter? What's the relevance of it? Maybe you think of it like a man who's been who's taken over a family business, and he's taken it over when he got to an old enough age, and been trying to develop that business for years and years and decades, and then the business just tanks. And everything he's put his effort into and everything he's tried to develop and everything he's tried to pursue, it's gone now. He's lost it. And he just thinks, I've lost my sense of worth. I've lost my value. I've lost my purpose. That's what happens when we wrap up our value in something other than the way God views us. When our value is in our job and then we lose that job, we think I'm worthless. When our value is in certain relationships and we lose that person in our life, or even in a marriage, and that marriage fails because one or both spouses was not loving the other and was not trying to help develop that relationship. And then you lose that. And that was your sense of value, was in that other person. And now you think, what's the point of living? We stop looking at how God views us. We stop looking at the cross. We stop looking at the fact that God sent his son to die, not for the perfect and best people in the world, but he sent his son to die for everyone, including the most sinful, the most vile, the most broken, the most weak, the most immoral. He sent him to die for those. God wants even the worst of society. He wants even the worst of the humanity to come and obey the gospel. And he says, it's worth it if I can get them to send my son to die. He struggles with this thought. I'm worthless. My life is not worth living. And it's just not true. But then another point that you could see from this text, from verse 4. It's my fault that other people won't change. He says in verse 4, let my life end. Just God, put me out of my misery because I'm no better than my father's. Now imagine what he's saying. He's probably talking about his fathers, the prophets, the people who have come before him, how they have made so many attempts to try to get people to turn back to God and trying to lead them in the right direction, and they weren't that successful at times. And so he may have been going into this saying, I will make even a bigger difference than they did. But now after chapter 18 and still nothing seems to have changed, Elijah says, well, I'm no better than my father's. I didn't make that significant of a difference. It's my fault that these other people didn't change. I remember I mentioned last time I was here that I'm working at a boarding school, and the students just got back from spring break, and we had a student who went home, and his mom told him, give me your laptop for the whole week. I don't want you going in there playing video games. I don't want you being online all week. I want you to go outside. I want you to spend time with us. I want you to do other things. I just don't want you on your laptop. He said, okay. He gave his mom his laptop and then came back to school a week later. Mom was helping him pull in luggage, and she opens his luggage, and there's a laptop sitting inside his bag. She says, what's this? And he says, oh, that's a laptop that I rented from school right before spring break because mine was kind of messed up, and they're allowed to rent laptops from the school and use it for school purposes. And he said, yeah, I forgot it was in there, but I haven't used it all spring break, and I promise. And she's doesn't believe him. She's very upset. She brings the issue to us. We start asking him questions, and we say, when's the last time you used this laptop? He said, it was well before spring break. We start going through his search history on his computer, and we say, try again. When's the last time you were on this laptop? Yesterday? Question mark. He got caught lying to his parents all week, and then he lied to the staff when he was brought back. And then even worse, we found out he was using school property to look up inappropriate material on the internet. And so that got him into a whole lot more trouble because of that. Dad was fuming. Mom was upset and crying. And this was not the first time she's had this issue of lying and deception from her son. And she, in tears, she was just saying, I feel like I've just failed as a parent. And I've been trying my best. I thought I was doing the right thing, but she felt like it was her fault that her son was still making these types of mistakes. And it's hard, I suppose, not to feel that way when we're trying to lead people in our lives in a better direction, trying to help them make better choices, trying to lead them to the gospel, trying to lead our children. But at the same time, God has created people with a free will that they can choose whether or not to follow those who lead in the right direction. I suppose I would ask this question, that especially in the context of parenting, who do you think the best parent is ever? Most likely I would say God. I don't think there's any greater parent than God, the only parent that actually knows it all. Who has more disobedient children than God? I don't know. I don't think anybody does. God is the greatest parent that has ever been, and he knows everything. He knows his children better than anyone else, knows their personalities, knows their habits, knows what they're going to do. God still has disobedient children because they can choose to follow that quality leadership or not follow that quality leadership. And I certainly understand, I don't want to underplay the fact that sometimes parents are going to make mistakes, and that will affect children, but it's also true that whether we're talking about parents, whether we're talking about evangelism or in other areas of leadership, we can be the best we can be, we can do the best we can do, and sometimes people will still not follow. And it's not always our fault that others will not change, and we don't need to always put that on ourselves. Just one more thought then that Elijah has here from these verses. I'm the only one struggling like this. Verses 9 through 14. There he came to a cave and lodged in it, and behold, the word of the Lord came to him. Wrong verse. Verse 14. He said, I have been very jealous of the Lord, the God of hosts, for the people of Israel have forsaken your covenant. They've thrown down your altars. They've killed your prophets with the sword. And I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it away. And the Lord said to him, go, return your way to the wilderness of Damascus, and when you arrive, you shall anoint Hazael to be king of Syria, and Jehu the son of Nimshi you shall anoint to be the king over Israel, and Elisha the son of Shaphat you shall anoint to be prophet in your place, and the one who escapes with the sword shall Jehu put to death. The one who escapes with the sword of Jehu shall Elisha put to death. Yet I will leave 7,000 in Israel, all the knees that have not bowed to Baal, and every mouth that has not kissed him. Elijah is loathing, and he says this twice in the chapter. I know we skipped over a little bit of material, but he says this twice in the chapter, that all these bad things have happened. They've torn down the altars, and now I'm the only one left. I'm the only one that's still faithful. I'm the only one that's still running for his life because everybody else is persecuting. And God says, no, you're not. 7,000 people still in Israel that still haven't bowed their knees to Baal, that are still just as faithful as you. And I don't think God was saying that just to show Elijah that he wasn't alone, but also to show him, you have fruits to your labor. A very likely case that there were still 7,000 people there who still hadn't bowed to Baal because Elijah had encouraged them. Elijah had helped to keep them strong. Elijah and his example and his preaching had kept their knees from falling down to a false god. He just didn't see it. He couldn't perceive the fruits of his labor, and he had a hard time being any kind of optimistic, and so he just had to look at things pessimistically and say, I'm the only one struggling like this. A common misperception that I think even we can have in the Lord's church. I'm the only one struggling with marriage issues. I'm the only one struggling with depression. The only one struggling with anxiety. I'm the only one having a hard time with my coworkers. I'm the only one struggling with this or that. And you'd be surprised how many other people in that same church you're in have the same problems, have the same challenges, have the same struggles. And I think one benefit of confessing our faults to one another is that we find out there are other people who can relate and other people who know how to help, other people who know how to make a difference in our lives. There were still 7,000 for Elisha to go and to seek help from. He had this negative, this destructive thought. I won't suffer any hardships. I have to be alone. I'm worthless. My life is not worth living. It's my fault that others won't change. I'm the only one struggling like this. God had a plan, though. God was already implementing his plan up to this point. He says, I need you to get up. He let him be in isolation for a while. Again, that short time of isolation can be good. But after that, he said, I need you to get up, and I need you to eat. I need you to take care of yourself. I need you to take care of your body. Then I need you to go out, and I need you to work. Don't just sit and loathe and wallow in your depression and your self-pity. I need you to get up, and I need you to go work. I need you to do something productive. I need you to go out and appoint these kings. I need you to go out and appoint your successor because your work's going to continue even after you're gone. Elisha's going to continue your work. Go appoint your successor. Go be productive. I think some of those things are very practical even for us today. When we're burdened down by these negative and false thoughts, when we're struggling with depression, when we just want to be alone, those are some things we can do. We can work harder to take care of our body, not just trying to avoid overeating, but even also depriving or malnourishing ourselves. We have to push ourselves to get up and get off the couch and to not just loathe and not just wallow in that self-pity. We have to get up and try to do something productive. We need to escape the thought of I have to be alone all the time and try to be around other people. Try to interact with other people. It's usually going to make us better. And to realize that the work we do, even when people don't follow us as leaders, we still make a difference in the kingdom, even if we don't always see it. God had this plan for Elijah. I want you to do these things. I want you to pull yourself out of this depression. But he didn't make him do it alone. God's plan for us? Well, he says, I want you to take all those lies you have. I want you to take all that abuse that you dish out to others. I want you to take all that hatred and that jealousy, all that sexual immorality, all of that sin. Hand it over. Give it to me. Because often those are the things that are actually contributing to us feeling depressed and feeling sad and feeling guilty. God says, hand it over. I want it. Put it in my hand. He takes all of that, puts it on the back of his son, marches up to Calvary. He says, these things will be nailed to the cross. They're no longer yours to bear. They're Jesus. We're going to stand. We're going to sing. We're going to offer invitation like we usually do. God told Elijah, go out and do these things. God says to us, arise and be baptized and wash away your sins, calling on the name of the Lord. If it's the case, you're weighed down by your own sins and your own guilt and your shames, and your actions are the things, and your thoughts are the things that have led to you feeling overwhelmed, this invitation's for you. If it's a case that you've struggled with some of these same negative thoughts and they have overwhelmed you, this invitation's for you, because God does not want you to bear those burdens alone. Let's stand and sing.